Hi, I'm Bob, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'd like to thank whoever was responsible for having my wife and I come here this weekend. It's a real special weekend for me. 2 days ago, I just celebrated 20 years of sobriety. And, and I can tell you, I wasn't living 20 years ago like I live today. I've got a fantastic life beyond my wildest dreams, I'll tell you that. If you're new here, if you're an old-timer struggling, you know, I think the foundation of being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and having a good life is really wanting it, you know. And I guess I wanted to live any other way than the way I was living, and I was willing to do anything to have a different way of life because I knew that I was just living a self-destructive life. And I was willing to do things another way when I found Alcoholics Anonymous, and my life is just absolutely, it's, you know, I don't know, it's like I lived in hell before. It's the easiest way to describe it, and I'm in heaven today. You know, that might sound corny, but that's the way it is. I feel that when I first got sober, you know, I was willing to do anything, and I had to do a lot of things, and they all seemed very, very impossible. But they were all done just one step at a time, and I really didn't know really what I was doing, you know, just by taking suggestions. But, you know, when I came, before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I always felt that I was my worst enemy. And after being sober 20 years, I realized today that I'm still my worst enemy. And the best thing that I can do today is to get up in the morning and surrender my life. And I like to do that by getting on my knees. There's been many years when I didn't do that, but I feel better when I give all of myself to God. When I realize that I need all of His help and I need to totally surrender my life and my will to Him. And I try to do that on a daily basis before I run out the door and start taking on my own life again, you know. I feel that before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, that I was as good example of self-will run riot that I know. I was full of all kinds of obsessions, not just drinking. You know, anything that made me feel good, I would go for it. And no matter who I had to hurt to get the feeling or get whatever I wanted, I was willing to do it, or I was willing to pay the price, or I was willing to hurt whoever I had to hurt. And that's just the way it was. I was a total animal. I was totally out of control. Right before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, nobody wanted anything to do with me. And I was just a young man in my 20s. And that's just the way it was. And that's the way I had made my life by running it the way I wanted and by trying to do the things that I wanted for myself. I was raised in downtown Long Beach with my mother and my brother, Long Beach, California. My mother was a drunk and my brother was a gambler. My brother was about 10 years older than me, so he was more or less like a father figure rather than a brother. So, you know, at an early age, I made a lot of vows that when I got older, I wasn't going to drink and I wasn't going to gamble, because the things that went on in our the apartment we lived on were just bad news. They were just kind of a dog-eat-dog situation. My brother was hustling my mother for money to gamble with, and she was hustling him for money to drink with. And I got real smart as a young kid, and while my mother was still passed out in the morning, I'd crawl in the closet and get in her purse and take a little bit of money. My mother was a drunk. You know, I knew where my mother was going to be after school. She wasn't going to be at home and have a nice hot chocolate cake made up for me like a lot of the other kids had. I knew where to find my mother. You know, I'd go down the corner bar, my mother would be sitting in there. And she was almost always sitting in there. If she was sitting in there, I got real smart as a kid. If she was sitting in there alone, I never bothered her because she might tell me to go home or do something. If she was sitting in there by some guy, I'd go in and bother him, you know, because I always knew that he'd slip me some money to get rid of me, you know, so he could sit there with my mother. And, you know, I just got smart as a kid and learned to play all of the little angles, you know. Living in a situation like this, I learned, you know, like I say, to take from my mother and steal. And, you know, I knew if she wasn't home that if I got a little bit of that money that I'd be able to go and get a hamburger and a milkshake or whatever. And I just started living kind of a self-survival basis. And that's more or less how my life was. And it just continually got worse. I had one friend that I used to go to his house a lot after school. His mother always cooked dinner, so I would usually always be over there around dinner time and kind of hanging around, and his mother would always say, "Bob, would you like to have dinner with us?" And I'd say, "Oh, I guess, you know." And but, you know, there was a feeling in this place with this boy and his mother. His father had been killed in Pearl Harbor or something like that, but, you know, there was a feeling that I wanted where this boy and his mother was. I mean, he always had his clothes ironed, and, you know, she always cooked dinners, and they had fresh vegetables, and you know, there was a feeling after we'd eat and lay on the floor and watch TV, the two of us, there was a feeling of warmth and caring there, and I didn't have that in my place, and I wanted that, you know. And a lot of times I'd get on my bicycle and ride home at 8, 9 o'clock at night, and it'd be dark, and I'd get real scared that when I got home, my mother being a drunk, a lot of times she was violent, and she would kind of bang me around, or worse yet, I'd go home and nobody would be there. And that's when I was really terrified, and I always had a lot of fear, and I was always real scared to death. I'd be in this apartment building in downtown Long Beach. In this apartment building, there was a lot of prostitution going on. There was a lot of stuff going on, you know, whatever goes on in a deal like that. And I used to see all this stuff, and I was scared, and I'd get in bed and cover up my head and pray that I'd wake up the next day. Or a lot of times I'd hear footsteps out the door and stand there with a butcher knife. You know, just a kid, maybe 10, 11 years old, and this is the way it was. And you know, all of those thoughts you have when you're that age of, you know, hey, when I get older, you know, God, just let me live through tonight, and when I get older, I'm going to get out of this deal, and I'm going to move away and have a nice little house. And I see these men come and go with these prostitutes and stuff, and I think, yeah, that guy's probably married. And, you know, it seemed like everybody had a selling out price. And I thought, you know, when I get older, it's not going to be that way. I'm not going to have this happen. I want to have things good and right. And anyway, as I started, I got a little bit older, and I started dating different girls, and every girl I'd go with, I was madly in love with. I think, yeah, this is a girl, when we grow up and we get a little bit older, well, I can get married, and you know, I'll move away, and all of this stuff will come true that I've been wanting, you know. And as it turned out, I went with different girls, and when I was 15 years old, I was going with a girl that was 13. And we decided that we'd get married, and we found out that you could go to Utah and legally get married when the boy was 16 and the girl was 14. So right after we both had our birthdays, we got on a Greyhound bus, and we went to St. George, Utah, and we got married, and I knew everything was going to be okay, you know. All of my dreams were going to come true now. Things were going to be in my hand and in my control. I mean, we quit school, and anyway, we came back and we got this little apartment, and I got a job, and I'd go to work in the daytime, and my wife would go over to her mother's house, and this went on for 10, 11 months, I guess. I'd go to work, she'd go to her mother's house. One day I went to work, she went to her mother's house, and I've never seen her to this day, you know. And took me a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous to realize how sick I must have been back then. You know, a lot of guys would go running around going to gun their wife down. Where is she? You know, I never even looked her up. You know, she didn't come home. I didn't go over there. I thought, hey, I'm not gone. And, you know, I don't know if she's alive or what. Now, that's been many, many years. But what happened, I ended up moving back with my mother. And by this time, my brother had gotten married. And I started running around with some of my school friends. One of them was that guy that I used to go over to his house all the time. It was him and a couple other buddies. And, you know, I'd been dating these girls and had been married for a short time. And, you know, I kind of really didn't know what was going on. But when I started running around back with these my old friends that I went to school with, by this time they were all riding around in these lowered cars and drinking and smoking weed and taking pills. And, you know, it wasn't, you know, I didn't know anything about any of that stuff. And it wasn't long before I found myself riding around in this 55 Lord Buick, smoking weed, drinking, and taking pills. And I can tell you, you know, what alcohol did for me in just one situation. I could tell you the deal and sit down, because I can remember being at a stop sign in this car with these three or four guys, whatever it was, the music going real good. We're in this 55 Lord Buick, you know, looked real bad, you know. And I'm in here, this car with my three or four righteous partners, buddies, and we're smoking weed, and I'd just taken some Bennies, and they had just started popping, you know. I was just, you know, like, wow, you know, and the music and drinking and smoking this weed. And I looked over at these people in this car next to me, an older couple that were waiting for the stop sign, and I thought, you know, these dumb people don't know what we got in this car, you know. I thought, I hope when we're 40 or 50 years old, all of us in this car can just stay together and keep doing this, you know. And that's what alcohol did for me. Because before, I always felt less than. I was always the kid in school that needed a haircut and had holes in his knees of his jeans and had holy tennis shoes. And I mean, we had no money, you know, just zero, come from nothing, you know. When I ate at home, it was Campbell's soup, you know. That's what it was. And, you know, when I started drinking, it was a totally different deal. You know, everybody there, I always, if somebody had a nice car or had some nice clothes, I thought, man, that guy is somebody, you know. I'd tell somebody, oh yeah, that guy's an attorney, or he's this or that, you know. Everybody was some big deal, you know. And, you know, I was always afraid of people, always scared, always, but when I started drinking, none of that made any difference, you know. I didn't feel inferior around people. I was more bold. All of that, you know, that little thing in us that we care too much, you know. That's one of the problems with a lot of alcoholics, you know. Things get so heavy, you know, in our sobriety that a lot of times for me, I care so much, I just think, hey, you know, I just can't keep going on. It's because I care too much. I got to back off a little bit, you know. Well, that's the way it was before I started drinking. I cared so much about what people thought about me and how I could please them, but I couldn't live my own life. And when I started drinking, I was able to tell people, hey, I don't care what you think about me. I wasn't afraid to run up and hit somebody if I didn't like them, you know. Running around with these guys, we'd go get in fights with other guys and stuff. And I, you know, to be accepted with this gang of guys, I'd always try to, you know, like if we'd get in a fight, I'd run and try to hit the biggest guy just so my friends could say, hey, did you see what Bob did to that guy, you know. Or if somebody'd steal a black and white TV, I'd try to get a colored TV, just, you know, so I could, I needed this acceptance, you know. And at that time in my life, the combination of drinking and whatever I was taking at that time, that's just the way it was for me. And the acceptance from my friends was my whole life. You know, my mother being a drunk, it wasn't that my mother didn't love me. You know, I know that now. My mother had to do what she had to do. But at that time in my life, it was like I didn't feel like I was getting love. And when I ran around with these guys, I mean, looking at it now, I can see that I was just their acceptance. That was me like seeking love, you know. I was being accepted by these guys, and I needed it. And if I could get that extra little pat on the back from stealing something or hitting somebody, anything, whatever it took to be accepted, it was okay. And what was happening to me is all of those things that when I was younger, that I was waiting to grow up and be the real Bob that God had made to live his own life and to live this good life that I always had inside of me, all of those things, those values that I had just slowly just went away. And it was more important for me to please this guy over here for the acceptance or whatever, and the combination of drinking and taking the drugs. And I can tell you, for a couple of years, the drinking and all of that stuff worked real good. You know, it worked at 100%, like it did that night when I was at that stop sign. You know, all of that, those things I was taking, for the first time maybe, or maybe for the first few times, they worked at 100%. They all did what they were supposed to. But pretty soon they didn't, you know, and I'd still try to capture that 100% in it, and then they didn't work, you know. Pretty soon it was 80% and 70%, and I found out after a period, you know, of a few years, still taking the combination of whatever I took, that if I stayed up for days at a time, sometimes the pills or the drinks or whatever I was taking would work better because my resistance would get real low, you know. And this is more or less the way I went on. You know, I lived with my mother. I got a little job at this General Motors at an assembly plant in Southgate, and I used to go to work, and one day I was at home with my mother, and this girl knocked on my door that I was one of these girls that I used to go with when I was like 11 years old. She was one of my she was my childhood sweetheart. She's the girl that I always wanted to be with, you know. And she's sitting right here tonight. That's been almost 38 years or so. You know, it's unbelievable. Anyway, she knocked on my door, and she had just left her husband, and she heard that I was split up from my my wife, and we began to laugh and talk, and God, it was good to see her. I mean, we had gone together and split up and gone together and seen each other in school and, you know, and did all this, you know, just all the kid stuff of all the little kid games, and then we ended up both marrying somebody, and as it turned out, she came by that night, and it was good to see her, you know, and we laughed and talked, and we were talking about all the old friends, and we did that for a half hour, an hour or so, and then she said, hey, let's go out, and I said, yeah, let's go, we'll take a ride, and, you know, all of a sudden, we got something to drink, and we started getting loaded. I think she had some weed or we got something, and we just started doing this night after night. And you know, it was really good. I was with the girl that I always wanted to be with, and I was drinking again, and everything just seemed just right. And you know, just a short time before that, you know, I had run around with these guys for a while, and I'd learned how to do all this stuff, and we got arrested one night, and the narcotic agents had been watching my friends. We left this party and they stopped us. One of my friends broke and ran, and the police ran after him, and they shot him in the back with a .357 Magnum jumping over a fence. It didn't kill him, but, you know, he had a big hole in him. but, you know, I found myself in jail for the first time in my life. You know, that scared me so bad. My friends, like I said, they had been arrested for marijuana before. And what happened to them is we had a court of trial, and I was given 3 years probation, and they were sent to prison. And that's, you know, why I was sitting at home that night with my mother. You know, I had decided that, you know, I mean, time had gone by, and I wasn't running around or doing anything wrong. And then when I met up with her that night, everything seemed like a different deal. And we continued to go out night after night, and I just found myself just totally happy, you know. And we used to ride along and be drinking and say how stupid it was to be married, and that neither one of us would ever be married again, you know. And anyway, we went together for about 5 months. By this time, she had a little apartment, and one night we were over there, and it was like 3 or 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, and we'd been up for days taking these bennies and drinking and stuff, and we had ran out of everything, and we were coming down off all this stuff, and just out of desperation, that's how we decided that night that we should get married, you know. And by this time I didn't have any job, and I didn't work much because God, we were having so much fun, I didn't want to go to work, you know. And I tried to go to work, but she didn't want me to go to work either, so it worked out real good. I never worked, you know. And so I started doing a lot of things that people do when you don't work. I started stealing and cheating from people, and this is kind of way we started out. And anyway, I did get a job for a short period after we were married. I can remember right after we were married, and I did lose that job. We had a great big party, and we invited all of our friends over, and a lot of our friends were all getting out of prison and everything. These were the kind of guys that we hang around with. And, you know, that night I felt real responsible as a man and as a husband. And I can remember the party going real good and the music and plenty to drink and everything. And I thought, you know, I'm going to have to start being responsible as a husband now and start getting our rent money. And I borrowed one of my friend's car and left the party, disciplined myself enough to leave this good party to go out to pull a burglary so I could get our rent money, you know. And I know, looking at me, I look like I'm a librarian or an accountant or something. You know, I always did have that clean-cut look. Always had my hair cut short. Always played that to the hilt. Because I never wanted people to know what I really was. Because as time went on, I just became a complete, the worst thing you could think about anybody. That's what I was, you know. I was just more than a liar or a cheat. My mother, that I always thought was so bad and such a drunk and all that, my mother wouldn't allow me in her house. She knew that I would steal something, and I would. That's the kind of person I had become. I always used to think that I was a good con or I was a good cheat because I would even cheat my friend. I used to think that was really a good deal. I can remember reviewing myself and thinking, hey, I'll even beat him, you know, my best friend, you know. When he leaves, I'm going to hit on his wife, or I'm going to take his wallet, or I'm going to take his watch that I seen laying in the bathroom. Those are the kind of things, and I think they'll never think I did it, because, you know, I don't appear to be that kind of a person. Well, anybody that knew me for any short period of time knew better, you know. But anyway, to make a long story short, I ended up going to to jail for various offenses, a lot of things that I used to do to impress my friends. The time came when my friends weren't even around. I was a married man. I was by myself out getting arrested for petty thefts and cheating people, anything, like I say, because I wouldn't work, you know. I'd go to work for short periods of time. She had a child from this other marriage, and sometimes I would straighten out and I'd try to go to work, and I'd work just long enough maybe to be eligible to draw unemployment or disability or something like that. And along the way, we started having children of our own. We had a boy and then a girl 2 years later. By this time, we have three children. And, you know, I can tell you that we were married for 10 years. And it was just a total life of probation officers, jail, courtrooms, emergency centers, because, you know, I had become the kind of person that I was just totally out of control. I knew nothing about sitting at home and having a drink. For me to take a drink was to just run wild. Because that's what I did. Once I took a drink, I might take a drink and go to bed today, but it's going to start working on me. And once it's in my mind, it's all over. I like to call it the call of the wild, because, you know, you can be sitting here sober, and if you start entertaining the thought of a drink, you're going to go, you know. It'll just take you over. And my last 5 years of my drinking, I spent 2 years of that time in the Los Angeles County Jail. I can tell you that for many years I was going in and out of jail. I became a periodic drunk. I knew I was totally out of control, and once I started drinking, my cycle usually ended up in the county jail. Once I was out of control, I had to go until I was locked up, and it was just that simple. I know for a nice, clean-cut looking guy like me, you'd never think that I'd come in and rob you, you know, tell you this is a robbery or strong arm you or whatever, but that's just the kind of person I'd become. Once I was drinking, my mother or any of my old friends, nobody wanted anything to do with me. I was a very obnoxious person. I had become a periodic drunk. I would drink, like I say, until I was locked up. I'd stay in jail. I'd see my whole life for what it really was again. And I'd see, God, I can't drink. And I'd go to church. They'd have people come in on Sunday, and little old ladies, and play the piano. And we'd sing, all these church hymns and stuff. And I'd have tears in my eyes because maybe I was going to go home in a couple of weeks. And I think, you know, God help me, you know. And I just didn't know what to do. I didn't have anything going for me. I had no defense against that first drink. And I knew that I was an alcoholic for many, many years. The last 5 years of my drinking, I was in the county jail, 2-3 years of that time, and the other 2 years my wife and I we lived in rescue missions and Salvation Armies, and we lived on Skid Row and all the way through California and up into Oregon, and we lived however we had to live as a young couple. And you know, at the beginning of my talk I talk a lot about taking drugs and all this stuff, and I can tell you the last 2 years of our drinking, mainly we only drank wine. We were on the streets and we didn't have friends that had drugs and stuff like this, and you know, we were lucky just to get a bottle of wine. And if we could have a room together, we, you know, the sad part about the alcoholic's life, I can remember being in a rescue mission, and they had actually given my wife and I a room together, and we were in the same bed together, and we'd both had a shower, and they gave us some little pajamas, and she had snuck in a bottle of wine, and we were laying in this bed, and we started laughing like, hey, haven't we put it over on society, you know? We were in our mid-20s, and we thought we were fooling the world, you know. At that point in our life, we had children that we had left. We had totally abandoned, and that's just the way it was. You know, I was running from the law, had no family. I always thought my mother was so bad. My mother ended up taking care of our children, you know. And anyway, we came back to Long Beach, and to make a long story short, my mother met us and had my children, and I can remember seeing my daughter in the back seat of a car, and she was totally terrified when she seen her mother and father. You know, I was like 29 years old. I was all bloody and muddy and skinny and purple-faced, and, you know, I was finished. My life was over. I thought my life, I wanted to die for a long, long time. You know, we were real, real sick, and we came and stayed at my mother's house, and we got well, and we got a little wino motel, and we started working, and we never quit drinking, and we were incapable of taking care of our children, and that's just the way it was. And, you know, our life was over. And one morning I woke up, and I went over to the liquor store, and I got a bottle of whiskey and a six-pack of beer, and I was drinking it, and when my wife woke up, and I told her, you know, it's getting close to Christmas, and I said, tomorrow let's quit drinking. It was our day off together. We both worked at the same restaurant. I was a cook, and she was a waitress, and I said, let's quit drinking tomorrow. And that day we ended up going over to Wilmington in this little junk car that we had. It was a little town next to Long Beach. And we went over there to my wife's ex-husband's house. And we used to go over there and get a lot of drugs in from him and stuff. And that day we were over there drinking and taking drugs. And when we came back, I ran this car into a telephone pole. My wife was passed out on my lap, and as it turned out, the police took me away that night, and my wife walked away, and I thought I'd never ever see her again. And as it turned out, I couldn't get out of jail because the police had a hold on me. They had been looking for me for a burglary, and there was no way I could be bailed out of jail. And I found myself in the old county jail in Los Angeles, and you know, I knew I was on my way to prison. I had been given a lot of breaks before for various offenses, and I knew it was all over this time, you know. And it really didn't make any difference. My life was finished, you know. One night, some man yelled out in this his cell. They came and took him away on a gurney, and he was laying on a mattress in the floor in the cell next to me. And I just happened to be on the floor on a mattress, and somebody said he got bit in the head by a rat, which I don't think was true. But as it turned out that night, after it got quiet, I laid there that night, and I seen my whole life for what it really was. That night something happened to me because I just didn't want to be Bob anymore. I always thought I was so slick and so cool, and my motto was kind of like, hey, I can take care of business. I always thought, hey, I can get out of this jail, I can go out there and fool those people one more time, I can put the whole deal off, you know, I can go to work and get the job and tell everybody all the right answers. And that night I just didn't want to be Bob anymore. It was just that simple. I thought if I could be like the dumbest idiot in the world, I'd be better off than being Bob. And since that night, my life has been in a different direction. It wasn't long after that a man from the probation department came to interview me to find out whether they were going to give me probation or send me to prison. And I told this man that I was an alcoholic, and that if I was given probation, that I would go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had been to Alcoholics Anonymous a few years before. I had got a drunk driving and I had to go up to some meetings, and I went to meetings, and I thought I was sober at the time. My wife and I both went to some meetings. Her parents, not her parents, but her aunt had this restaurant, and one of her employees was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we went, of course, it wasn't in our town, it was a little bit out of our town, and we'd go out there to these meetings. I guess we went for 2 or 3 months, whatever it was, but I always took Valium. Because I thought, God, if they call on me to talk, I don't want to appear nervous or anything, you know. And, we always smoke weed. I didn't think that counted, you know. I can remember, you know, in Long Beach, they have little ice cream trucks come by, and you can run out and get banana splits. All the kids run out and get hot fudge sundaes and stuff on the hot summer nights. You can sit on your steps, and, you know, we'd go out and get a banana split. And, of course, before the ice cream truck come, we'd always smoke a couple of joints, you know, weed, and we'd go out and get a nice banana split, be sitting there all loaded on weed, and with its ice cream, you know, and the fudge running down your face, and look up at the sky, and say, I told her, God, isn't the sobriety fantastic, you know? You know, I thought we were sober, you know. I don't know if you're smoking weed or you're taking Valium or any of that stuff, but sober means sober, you know, just what it means, nothing, you know. And, you know, I'm glad I did all the things because when I got here this time, I couldn't play any more games with myself. You know, I had to be real honest with myself, and I don't know if I was capable of being honest with anything or anybody or myself. But I thank God that God made me aware that I, you know, of certain things that I knew I couldn't do, and actually they were truths for me. You know. And I didn't know they were called that then, you know. But as it turned out, I got back to my cell, and I heard myself telling this probation officer that I would go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, hey, I know I'm an alcoholic without a doubt. And it was like, it was so clear. You know, I mean, I had stole and I robbed from people and I'd done all kinds of things. And I didn't really feel like I was a robber or a stealer, though, although I did it, I guess I was. But I really knew I was an alcoholic without a doubt. I thought, yeah, that's my problem. And as it turned out, I went to court and I was given 6 months in the county jail. I was sent to a road camp and I was given 3 years probation. And I was sent to a road camp that I had served a year in for a robbery 5 years before. I pulled into this little road camp where they, it was like a firefighting road camp, and they had guys that worked on little road crews and stuff. And there was a sheriff department where the police that were in charge of this road camp. I came back there 5 years later, almost 5 years exactly. I had been gone 5 years before. I was in there and I had served a year. I got back there 5 years later. There was four of the same sheriff's officers that worked there then, and there's only like 10 altogether, that were still there and knew me. And when I walked in the door, they said, welcome back, Bob, you know. And it was just a very strange thing because the Los Angeles County jail system is real big. It's like a city, you know. I mean, there's camps all over and thousands of men. To end up back at the same place was just a very, very strange thing. In that camp, the first time I went there, I told them I was a cook. And anyway, I learned how to cook and I learned how to bake. And as it turned out, when I got back there 5 years later, I was assigned back to my same job as the baker for this road camp to do all the baking for the officers and all of the inmates. And I ended up back in the same little bakery where I went in there and had left 5 years before. There was like handwritten recipes I had wrote for different things that were in there that I had left 5 years before that were still in there. And, you know, something happened to me in that road camp because Alcoholics Anonymous came in there and I started going to the meetings, and it was like somebody being out in the ocean floating, and you know, all of a sudden here come a ship and something to grab onto. And when I first seen Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew I was an alcoholic and I knew I wanted them. When I first seen them come in, they didn't seem like a big ship. You know, it was just kind of like an inner tube, and I grabbed on. But, each week it seemed like when they'd come every Thursday night, it was a better deal. And I had more questions to ask them, and I got more curious, and I got the big book off the library truck when it came, and I started reading it, and I started finding out about what it was to be an alcoholic, And I'd ask these guys different questions. And I remember I told this guy, I just said, hey, you know, I said, I told him all these problems. And I said, my wife's out running on the streets still, and I'm in here. And, you know, I've made a decision. I'm going to have to let her go because we've been married 10 years. And, you know, we do real good when for a while. And then all of a sudden we'll drink together and we just, you know, and it's all over. And I know we need to be apart. And I was willing to do this. And I tell him all this. And he'd tell me, you know, things like, he'd say, hey, look, he said, if you want Alcoholics Anonymous and you want to be sober and you want it more than anything, you know, all you have to do is have that desire. And you have to want it more than anything. And that's still the main ingredient today for any of us, you know. We're not going to have this deal if we don't want it, you know. And I love my life today. I didn't know my life was going to get this good, you know. I know today that I'm living exactly the way I always wanted to live when I was a younger man. All of those dreams and fantasies, they've all come true, and they've been better. And I kind of feel that since I've been sober, I've allowed God to work in my life, and I've let Him use me for an example for a lot of things. A lot of things I may not have been good examples, you know. All of us fit in a certain niche, you know. But I have been moved from a total point of hell to a point of heaven today. That's what it is. I'm living a perfect, peaceful life. The only thing that ruins my life today is me. When I start thinking and think something wrong and get it down into my stomach and go, oh, you know. And then I have to tell myself, wait a minute, that's the other deal, you know. You know, everything's okay. You know, I can mess it up. But, I kept going to those meetings. And, you know, I never told you, I went to jail a lot. And we were married, and from when we very first started, when I first started going to jail for 5 days, 10 days, whatever it was, my wife and I never corresponded. It was easier for me not to know what she was doing out there, and it was easier for her not to see me locked up. And so whenever I went to jail, a lot of times if I was with her and was arrested, that'd be the last time I seen her until I came out. Sometimes we never even knew whether we were going to be back together. We didn't know if we had a relationship. Sometimes I'd come out, we'd get right back together. Sometimes it might be a month or 2 months, you know. Just however it worked out till we slowly met and talked and whatever happened, you know. I was in this jail, and I knew I was probably going to have to let my wife go or whatever. My mother had our children. My wife was on the street still running, and my mother would bring my children up, and I'd see them. And, of course, you know how mother-in-laws are. They always come and tell you what the daughter-in-law is doing, you know. And she'd always come and bring all the bad information. But one time she came and said that my wife had been out running with some of my other friends, and she had been arrested for some robberies. And then the next time I saw her, that she said that my wife is in the hospital and she was dying with hepatitis. My wife had a real bad liver, and they said that if she ever got hepatitis again, that she would die. She had it twice before. And as it turned out, my mother came up and told me that she was in this hospital, and one day I was serving food in the mess hall, and I just broke down and started bawling like a baby. And I went outside, and this other black man, a friend of mine, came out and put his arm around me, and I just bawled like a baby to him. And I said, hey, I don't know how this all happened, you know. I said, all I wanted to do was just to be a good, decent human being and be a good father and a good husband and have the little house out somewhere and a regular job. And here all this time has gone by in my life, and I'm living like this, and here I am in jail. My wife's dying. My kids are somewhere else. And everything just seemed like a total nightmare, you know. And one day I came in from the mess hall, and on my bunk there was a letter from my wife, and she wrote me, and which I said was very unusual. And she told me that she was getting better, and I was just real happy for her. And I wrote her back, and we began to correspond. And she said that she was transferred to another hospital, and she's met some other man. And this other guy told her about AA, and she ended up going to Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And she wrote back and said that she met somebody in a meeting that told her about a woman's recovery house. And at that time, almost 20 years ago, I mean, that was just Well, that's all there was, very few of those. That we didn't even know anything about recovery houses then. You know, we were scared before 20 years ago when we were drinking. My wife and I were scared to tell people we were drunks. We were afraid they'd put us in jail, you know, especially with children. If you went and told a welfare worker or something that you were a drunk, they'd, you know, like take your kids away and stuff, you know. And so anyway, she was made aware of this woman's recovery house, and as it turned out, she went to this woman's recovery house, and she started writing to me and telling me about all of the nice things that were happening to her in this place, and how the women were real nice to her, and you know, I just felt so good for her, and I was so happy that she was alive. And you know, I just really didn't know whether we were going to be together or not. We had been married 10 years, and we didn't have own a knife or a fork together, or you know, a pot or anything. This is the way we lived. When you live a life of just full of obsessions, you know, there's nothing nice where you live in a home. If you have to go drink or go get some dope or something, I mean, you're going to go take the lamp. You know, you might have a house full of furniture and everything might be going real good. Maybe you haven't drank for quite a while, 6 months, and you've done it on your own, and you start drinking. Pretty soon this goes, and then this goes, you know. Once the money goes out of the pocket and you quit going to work, there's no more money come in, then we start selling things, you know. We start taking things. We start stealing things. That's the way it always was. That's the way we always lived. We never had anything. We were never able to buy clothes for our children. Our clothes were always given by somebody, AA people. At one point there, when we went to AA for a short period of time, this one man that was in AA that worked for my wife's family, he used to bring clothes over all the time because he knew. See, he knew. He was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was an alcoholic. He knew the disease was running rampant. A lot of other people might not have known. They might have thought we were bad or whatever, you know. You know, anyway, the time come for me to get released from jail, and I left Los Angeles and got on a Greyhound bus, and took that bus down to Long Beach, not knowing what I was going to do. Any other time before, I knew when I left the county jail, like I say, I'm going to take care of business. I'm going to get out there and get that job. I'm going to get this, get everything back together. I had done that too many times, and it didn't work. I had had all those tough things. They meant nothing. Because once I started drinking, they were all gone, and I was back in jail again. This time I knew that I had to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I took the bus down to Long Beach. I went to this woman's recovery house where my wife was. I wanted to see her, and I knocked on the door. My wife, I told this lady, she came to the door, and I said, I'd like to see my wife, Gloria, and who I was. And she asked me to step in this room, and I stepped in there, and I waited. It seemed like for a long time, and my wife come walking through that door. And, you know, that was almost 20 years ago. And my wife is standing there sober. I thought I'd never, ever see my wife again. You know, my wife and I were married for 10 years. And if you're living an alcoholic life like we did, I guess we did everything humanly possible to hurt each other as a human being, you know. And it was just out of our sickness. And none of that counted that day, because she was Gloria. She was a girl I knew when we were 11 years old, and we had always been friends, and it didn't make any difference whether we were husband or wife or what. I was glad to see her still alive. She was standing there sober. I was sober, and God, I was glad to see her. And she said, hey, I really love it in this house, and these women are so nice to me here, and God, they got clean sheets and flowered toilet paper and so, I mean, things that we hadn't seen in years. And, you know, she told me that, and I was so happy for him. She said, I want to stay here in this house. And I said, hey, I think you should. And any other time when we got eye contact, and, you know, after me being away, a lot of times we'd decide to take off, maybe beat somebody for some money on the way out. And it wasn't that way this time. And she asked me if I'd like to come over and have dinner with the girls and go to a meeting with them that night. And that's how my sobriety left. From going to Alcoholics Anonymous in jail, I came out, and God moved me into that situation. I've been protected all the time. I've been under the scope and the hands of God. It's just been that simple, you know. Once I turned my life over to Him, I've been taken care of. For 20 years, I've been taken care of. Because in the morning, I get up and I do what I'm supposed to do. And it's evidently, it's always been the right thing to do. Because I have done what I was supposed to do and not what I wanted to do. And before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I did what I wanted to do and not what I was supposed to do. If I wanted to do something and it would feel good for me right then, I was willing to pay the price and I'd hope that there was no price to pay. You know. And that's the difference. That's the difference between turning your will and your life over to God as you understand it. That's what they mean by surrender. When I was... My wife and I, we went to some meetings for many, many nights with these other women in this car. I found myself riding in this car, going to meetings with four or five women and me jammed in. I just got out of jail. I'd been lifting weights and, you know, trying to look real big so everybody'd think I was real tough and all this stuff, you know. And here I found myself riding around like this night after night with these women. And I remember riding on freeways, looking at lights and thinking, hey, what's it all going to be about? You know, what's going to happen? You know, is this going to be, this is a new deal, you know, let it go. And I'd see police cars and stuff go by and I'd think, gee, did they see me? You know, because before I always used to be hiding from the police. I was always guilty, you know. And, you know, it's funny. My wife stayed in this deal. I went to my mother's house and... we did this night after night, and eventually we decided to get back together, and we got a little apartment right behind this woman's recovery house, a little room, and it had a pull-down bed. My mother still had our children. The months were going by, and my wife had been arrested with these other friends of mine for this robbery, and you know, her probation was violated, and she was supposed to go to prison for a year if she ever got in any more trouble, and she was in trouble. So I had been at home, and we were going to meetings, and things seemed to be getting good. And you know, the time came when we had to go down to the courthouse with my wife that day, you know, I didn't know what was going to happen. I was thinking, well, God, am I going to be able to stay sober? Or if she's locked up, am I going to be faithful to her? Am I going to start sneaking around and cheating like I did before? You know, all of these things, you know. God has taken care of everything. Because that day we went down to the courtroom. And I went in with her. And I sat in the courtroom. And my wife got up and stood in front of the judge. And the judge looked at a lot of papers and looked up at my wife and said, you know, he said, I have a lot of letters here from people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think you've had some kind of change in your life. He said, I'm going to reinstate your probation rather than send you to prison. And that day my wife and I ran out of that courtroom out into the sunshine down Ocean Boulevard in Long Beach like two little kids. Knowing that everything was going to be okay. And everything has been okay, you know. We're totally taken care of. From that day, I can remember laying on that pull-down bed and wondering what was going to happen with our life. And it's just got nothing but better, you know. One day, I was sober about 11 months. We were still in that little apartment, and I'd been doing as good as I could do to that point. And it was a beautiful Sunday morning, and there was a man and a woman going to church, and he had on a gray suit, and she had on a pretty flower dress or something. She looked real churchy, you know, both of them. And I looked at these people, and I thought, hey, you know, I'm sick and tired of being good. And right after I had that thought, I thought, wait a minute. I haven't been living the way the structure of religion or society wants me to live. I've been living by this deal that I found here in Alcoholics Anonymous. This gut level deal of knowing when I'm nickel and dime compromising, if somebody says, hey, how you doing? And I say, oh, I'm doing good, you know. And I think, God, why didn't I tell him I don't feel good? You know, that little deal, that meter inside of us. Well, that day I realized that that was my God. And since that time, you know, that's been... almost 19 years, that has been my God, because I've come to realize what God was. Before I was God, I had to make all the moves, you know. And I started realizing that if I followed this little meter, this gut level deal, this was God within me, and it's within all of us, you know. And if we follow this thing and do what is right that comes from us, we're doing the right thing, you know. And that's the way it's been for me. Many, many things have happened to me. I continued to be a cook. I cooked in jail. I got a job as a cook. I started riding the bus to work. I didn't have a driver's license because I had it taken away from me. Before, I always drove a car if I didn't have a driver's license. It just meant if I got caught, I'd go to jail for 10 or 15 days. And, you know, I had to quit thinking like that. And so I didn't drive a car. We didn't have a car. Eventually, we got a car. Somebody sold us a car for $50. My wife started driving me to work, and then she would take other women to meetings, and she'd pick me up, and then she'd bring AA people into the restaurant where I was working, and after meetings, and they'd all wave to me. And I can remember standing back there with tears in my eyes, you know, with that self-pity, thinking, man, you know, I got to work on Friday night and Saturday till 2 in the morning. I mean, I really felt bad. I thought I was going to have to do that forever, you know. Always going to be a cook working on graveyard or something, you know. And but God takes care of things, you know, because my first sponsor was a painter, and I always admired him and his life. I just thought it was this guy goes and he paints Monday through Friday, gets up, goes to work at 7, and he's off at 3:30, and he has weekends off, and he can go off and do things. I just thought it was so neat, and I just thought it would be a neat deal. And one day I told him that, hey, if you ever get a lot of work, well, God, give me a chance. I'd like to learn how to paint. And one day he came to me and he said, well, he said, I got this big motel if you want to go ahead and quit your job. Because by this time we had our children back. The time came when we had to go get our kids, and it was real hard on my wife to try to be a mother and for me to be a father, and the responsibility was a heavy deal, and we had to take it on. It was time. But, you know, we had our children, and we were trying to make it, and I went to work with him, and I worked with him for about 3 months. I learned how to paint. One day he said, well, that's the end of the job. And I said, God, you mean there's no more work? He said, well, just go get a job. I said, well, God, I don't know how to paint, you know. You know, and I didn't really think I was a painter, and I got scared and was full of fear, and so I went back to being a cook again, and I went back and got a civil service job back where I worked for the Los Angeles County Jail. They used to pay me 50 cents a day. And then, you know, as a cook, and I told them I was a cook, and I tried to get hired in there, and they wouldn't hire me. And finally, I insisted, and I went up, and I got three supervisors in this room, and I was about a year and a half sober, and I told them what I was like, what happened, what I was like then. And they put me on a temporary probationary basis. And, you know, I kept that job, and I started there, and I was working as 2 years sober. I was a pot washer. I mean, they didn't start me out as a cook. I was just, well, I had to take whatever I could get to get a civil service job. And eventually, the temporary and the probation deal was all dropped, and I was a regular permanent employee with the Los Angeles County. And I had become a cook there. And what had happened is things were real hard for my wife and I. We were doing real good in AA and stuff, but it was hard for us to be responsible and to grow up, and it was hard. We had no money, and my wife had to work as a waitress on a graveyard shift, and I started learning how to paint and do this extra little painting. The little old lady across the street would want her bathroom painted or something, and I'd start doing that after work. And one day I came home in the afternoon. My wife was sleeping because she had been working graveyard shift, and I came in and I laid on the bed with her that afternoon, and I was all excited. The little old lady across the street had this big house that she owned, and she wanted me to paint it. And it was like I had this civil service job, and I had like a month work of painting, too. And I laid there, and I was all excited. I had this money, and I started talking to my wife. My wife says, you know, I think God wants you to be a painter. And that day I decided that I would quit that civil service job and try to make it as a painter on my own with as very little as experience as I had, knowing that if it didn't work, that I could always go back and be a cook. And from that day to this day, I've never been without work. Eventually, I had so much work that I had to hire other people. And you know, it was just that I was just honest, and whatever I told the people I'd do, I'd do it, you know. And honesty for a painter is painting behind the toilet, you know. Yeah. It's always a deal, you know, you're in a hurry and you want to get the money, and, you know, they'll never see back there, and I think, God, I better paint if they look, you know. But that was the whole deal, and you know, just that little philosophy made me learn a lot. And I knew, you know, whatever I tell these people, I better do it. And then I'd do a good job for this little old lady, and she'd tell her little neighbor friend, this other man, and pretty soon, you know, I never even advertised in my phone. Sometimes with my children, and we'd get scared about the rent being paid or whatever. And I think, God, if that phone don't ring tomorrow, we won't be able to pay the rent. And the phone always rang. I mean, God always had that phone ring. And that's when I really, I knew that I had a God. And as time went on, I just felt a closeness with something. This thing that I had tapped, this inner thing. Once you start following it, it's real. You know it's with you. And I used to tell my wife, always used to joke. She said, "Well, you got your partner with you, And it was just, I knew that if I did right, and it's always been that way. And I've never been let down. I've never missed a meal since I've been sober. I've been able to take care of my children. I've been able to, put my daughter through modeling schools and through a Christian school and things that, I never knew about. My wife and I have lived beyond either one of our parents of anything that they ever done. I mean, we've gone and done things that they were never capable or able to do. We have already experienced, thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm just so full because my wife and I have such a fantastic life. We've went on and, I became a painter, and the time came when I became a licensed contractor. I don't even think they have contractor's license out here for painting, but, to get a state license was a big deal, and I had to go take the test, and I had to put in my time to do that, and it was a big deal. And it just changed my whole standard of living materially. And I was able to just be that much more honest. All of the things that I haven't just come in here and taken the steps and just been wonderful. Everything has been done at the right time. My first sponsor, he didn't take his fourth and fifth step, and he was sober almost, it had been 2 years he'd been in AA and never taken it. And when one day he came up drunk, and it just scared me so bad, I knew that I hadn't taken my fourth and fifth step. And I knew that I was either going to have to be, I was either willing to take it or I was gone. I was next, And I knew I didn't want to go, and I was willing. And I took that fourth and fifth step. And, that's the way it's been with everything. When the time is right, you have to do it. Whatever your time may be for you, that's when you have to do it, And I just believe that any time I try to hang on to anything or make it my way, that it could be wrong, it could be very serious. I try to flow and do today what I think is right. And anything that I've learned today has been from you people. It's been 20 years of experience of watching and learning, I'm not a smart person. I don't read books. I'm not a big book person. My wife reads a book almost every night. I'm real good with numbers and math. She doesn't know nothing at that, so we trade off. But, I've been able to share this life with my wife, the one that I was willing to give up, and the only person really that I ever cared about in my whole life. We've been able to share this life together. When I was 1 year sober, my mother came to my 1 year birthday, and she had already quit drinking for about 3 months just because my wife and I had quit. She didn't say anything, or she just was watching, and she knew we weren't drinking, so she quit, And she had about 3 months when I had this 1 year, and she came to my 1 year birthday, and she liked Alcoholics Anonymous, and she wanted to stay sober and be a member of AA, and she asked my wife to be her sponsor, and they started riding around the daytime buying new curtains and fixing up her house, and God, everything was real neat. My whole family, was in AA, and it was just real good. And, after about a year or so, my mother started, she's nervous like I am. She said, "Bob, I'm just so nervous. I don't want to go to those meetings because they're going to call on me to talk, and I don't want to talk." She said, "I'm going to go to the doctor." And I said, "God, don't go to the doctor." I said, "They'll just give you some medication, And she said, "Oh, you're the one that had the problem taking pills and stuff." She said, "I've never taken any of that." I said, "Well, you better tell them that you're an alcoholic if you go to the doctor." And she went to the doctor, and she didn't tell them she was an alcoholic. And pretty soon they started giving her Librium, then Valium, and then Stelazine and Thorazine. And one day I went over there on a Saturday to see her, and she was laying laying on the couch, and she said, "Bob, turn the TV off. It's just killing me. I left and the TV wasn't on, and I could see my mother had lost her mind." And it was a real, real sad thing, because here's somebody that's come in, got a touch of a sober life through Alcoholics Anonymous, drank all of her life, and, you know, just had a bad deal through drinking, and then to come and get sober and have this happen, it just didn't fit. And I went back to my wife and told her, and I just felt, you know, I said, "God, my mom's like lost her mind. We had to take her to a psychiatric ward." And I told the doctor she was an alcoholic and that, you know, she was taking these pills, and all they did was took her off the pills she was taking and gave her some different ones. And she was there for quite a long time, and she never got any better. And it was real sad. We thought my mother was going to be in Camarillo or something, you know, some nut hospital. And one day my wife says, "Hey, I know what let's do with your mother." And, you know, she said, "Let's take her to a woman's recovery house. And those women that's got a few days sober or a week or a month, they'll love your mother back to being well." And we took her over there, and they did. And today my mother's still sober, and she's like 80 years old, you know. And she's still buzzing around. And, yeah, you know. And I've been so blessed to have the life that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me, and to live the life that God really made for me to live. I've been able to live that life because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been able to share my life with the one person that I always wanted to be with. I've been able to live it sober, and we've been able to experience and share things like coming here this weekend, and just one more experience that we have to share together, you know. I don't mind going out there and working real hard and doing what I have to do, because I know I get to do things like this, you know. Today, all of our children are sober. My stepson, the son that she had from another marriage, his mind was blown out on taking angel dust and drinking and stuff, and he was like a zombie when he came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And my son ran away from home when we were sober, when we were like when he was 13 years old. He ran away from home, and we had to experience that. We had to go to jails and see my son locked up and be on heavy medication in jails because he was out of control. My wife had to take my son to a psychiatric ward, and leave him there, and thinking maybe he'd never get out of there again. You know, I can tell you today that my son's sober 6 years, and he's a very active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My other, my stepson that I said to, he worked for me. He came and his mind was just like a zombie, like I say, and he started painting with me, and I'd leave him in rooms for hours just trying to paint one little room. And I'd say, "This guy, today he's a licensed painting contractor, and he's living out there. He's living in life. He's doing it." And my daughter, the girl that we put to Christian school, and we put her through modeling school, and she's beautiful, and we knew that she was going to be perfect, and she wasn't going to be like us. She ended up, when she was 16 or 17, a cheerleader, just leaving and running the streets down in Santa Monica Boulevard in Hollywood, and sleeping in her car, and all of those things. And today she's sober, you know, 4 years. And they're all active members of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I've been so blessed. My whole family's been touched. All of the people that God has put in my life through Alcoholics Anonymous, people like Burl and Ann and Chip and Mark. I seen this Mark come to California, and he was as nutty as a fruitcake. He had these wearing a pair of army fatigue. And I've grown to love him. You know, people you see, you walk in and you think, "Boy, somebody ought to throw that guy out of here," you know. But, you know, you come to love them. And I've been all over, into Canada and Colorado, and got all over with Burl. And I didn't plan it. I mean, we've just ended up being places together. And he has been very close in our life. And we just have so many friends like these people that God has given us through Alcoholics Anonymous. We've been so blessed. 20 years I've been living a sober life, and my wife and I have always wanted to ride around the South, and she's always said, "God, let's do it." And, you know, we decided when we came here this weekend, when we leave, we've got a rented car, we're staying, and we're going to ride all around the South for a week. And we're going back to New Orleans and get on the plane. And, you know, that's our 20-year DR, my birthday. And that's what we want to do, is be together and be grateful to be sober together and experience life together. And we deserve it, you know? We deserve it. We got to be good to ourselves. Sometimes I can just grind on myself and be so hard on myself. We gotta let up, you know. But I am so grateful that God has given me this life and this program and you people to share it with. Thank you.